Mr. Sherwood, Real 11. We were talking about when you joined the Department of Technical Intelligence. Now, you were in a subsection of that. Did that have a name, and when exactly did you join them?
Yes, it was General Staff Intelligence 10, or MI-10, which dealt with the technical aspects. And the particular department we were in dealt with, in fact, it was the technical department dealing with enemy equipment. The jobs we did covered a long range. One, we would have to collate as much information as became available about the development of enemy equipment, and that covered a whole range of artillery, tanks, small arms, and so on. And also to examine the equipment that had been captured from the enemy, find out any special things about them, and also, this is an important part, train the intelligence sections of British Army units in the handling of enemy equipment, so that if they captured enemy equipment, they'd be able to use it. And also show their how people in their units how to use it. So for that, we used to.
So when did you start this?
Towards the end of 43. Suppose it must have been, because.
How long were you back in Alexandria before you?
It must have been a month or two.
So around about July.
Round about July, I think it's probably a bit later than that. I have to check, but it's probably a bit later than that. Because I remember in Alexandria, we went back to Alexandria, and that's where I'd walked back or developed malaria. And again, sometimes things that should have been tragedies turned out to be, in my case, rather fortunate, because I had a very good malaria, to put it that way. First, and I can't explain that. First, there are two types of malaria, MT and BT. The MT was a malignant type, which would recur again and again throughout your life. There was a BT, a benign type, benign tertiary, BT was tertiary, which meant every 3 days you had rises, but would chance it off, wouldn't affect the rest of your life. I had the BT type, and it was the only way to affect me the rest of my life was that I could never give blood, donate blood, because there was a danger of coming developed it. I didn't know at first that I had it, therefore I had a temperature, but it became clear running a high temperature is impossible. I don't know if you know the course that malaria takes, but you feel as if you have a flu or something or other. Then your skin gets very dry, your temperature goes up and up and up, your temperature control mechanism is affected. Temperature goes up and up to Fahrenheit, it will be 104, 105, that sort of thing. And you feel terrible when that was happening. And suddenly it would click in, put a trigger in, and you'd perspire and sweat like mad, and your temperature would drop, plummet down to sort of more than normal, and you start shivering like mad. These were the rigors, I suppose, you had, and you shiver like mad, and then you'd be washed out. Then you would be soaking wet, and you were absolutely awful. But I was given medication. The medication then was a simple personal thing. And I remember also, I think it was a New Zealand officer, who came and steered the ward. We were in an Italian restaurant, an Italian hospital between Alexandria and Abu Qir, that's some distance north of Alexandria, and very fancy hospital, on staff. This young chap, an officer, came in and they couldn't figure out quite what was wrong. Something was wrong. Then they discovered that he continued taking his anti-malaria tablets even while he was in hospital. And that was suppressing the symptoms. So they didn't know, and they took the tablets away from him, and whoosh, then he went down with it in a big way, the malaria, and then of course had to start curing it, sort of thing. I was on some sort of medication as well, but after a few days perhaps, I was feeling much better, but I was still in hospital. there'd be the rounds in medical officer would come along in the morning and in the early evening, and so on. Now, I had met up with a family called Shalom in Alexandria. They had a daughter named Jacqueline, who was about 18, 19, 20, that sort of age. She, incidentally, by chance, was had met my brother when he was on his way to Crete several years previously. And in fact, when I visited their home, I saw in their visitor's book a little comment that he'd made, thanking them for their hospitality, which is rather nice. They were quite wealthy people, and they had a couple of cars, I think. Petrol, I don't think, was a big problem then. And she was able to drive the car. It might be the American Packard or something. And what used to happen was that after the medical officer, Emma, was round in the morning, I'd get dressed. She'd pick me up in the car. We'd drive up to Aboukir, which was an elephant fort. Then, of course, that would give a battle of Aboukir with Napoleon. Went out of the day there, maybe swim or whatever, present day there. Then she'd drive me back to the hospital. I said, I'm dressed into bed before the evening, Emma was around. And so that wasn't a bad way of having malaria, if you can. Most other malaria weren't that, most other people weren't that lucky. So I used to think, say that when I was in a gun position there, but when the other people saw what happened, they'd go around in the early evening at sunset with all their sleeves rolled up and their arms out waiting for mosquitoes to bite them.
Now, that was before you joined the technical department.
I then went from there to a base depot, for whatever reason, or presumably, I think the unit perhaps was being disbanded. So there was lots of that going on now, changing units, moving one to the other, making up different units and disbanding. And I went on this interview with the technical GSI 10, MI 10.
Now, what exactly was your role?
My job was, again, collating information on small arms.
Now, how did you go about collating information?
Well, information would come in from sort of written information from other intelligence units about things they found. Also, and this was exciting, and I can hardly believe that it happened, from agents in occupied Europe. The particular area was the Balkans, that was covered by Cairo. I was at GHQ Cairo at the time, to cover the whole of the Balkan area. And you get things coming in about things they notice on trains, trucks that were going around. And I'd send back messages saying, can you check, did they, these things look as if they had, I don't know, there was something sticking out in the front or whatever it was. I was thinking of like spy storybooks doing that sort of thing. And again, I was still at a very early age.
And this was mainly in small arms? You were
mainly small arms and artillery. And artillery, but it overlapped to some extent. I know that George Bonner was doing tanks, but the problem is they were overlapping because the Germans put field guns onto tractors, and that was a very powerful weapon they had. And the question was what guns they were putting onto tractors. And I remember I made a prediction about one particular gun that was, I said, oh, they're probably going to put that onto a Tiger tank chassis. But no, I didn't. I got that wrong. It's the only prediction I remember, anyway. But it didn't really matter because the war was starting to draw to an end.
So you were collecting information.
Collating information.
What else were you doing?
Okay, and then.
Oh, who would you pass the information to?
The information would go to general. Very senior people at GSI, where they decide what they're going to do with it.
So that's one part. What's the next part of your job?
Was training intelligence units, intelligence sections of various units that were passing through Egypt on the use of these things. And I still have photographs of what we used to do.
What sort of things would you do with them?
I was dealing chiefly with them. It would be small arms like the Schmeisser machine guns, portable. The sort of things you see in pictures and concentration camps, what the guards had strapped around their necks like that. It was a very efficient gun, MG 42, I think, one of them, because the big important thing, I think they decided, that rifles firing single unit, single bullets, not much good. So very unlikely you would ever hit anybody. The thing was to get as many bullets in the general area as you could. And that's where they were devoted to these automatic machine guns. So that, and because the range was much less, you couldn't use it more than a couple hundred yards. But you've got a large number of bullets in the general, and the chances were more, you had a greater chance of hitting something. Also, revolvers, Lugers, Valtons. And I remember, because we had a certain amount of training right at the first start with our own equipment, obviously stripping, putting it together, but then I had to learn how to strip and put together and teach and clean the German. There was a hand pistol, the Luger, which was a very famous one, the Valter. Also, had Italian weapons or whatever. There was that, and we used to take them out to firing ranges, also anti tank rifles. There was a German, there was a famous one they developed. I got a photograph actually firing it. It was a long thing that fired a very high powered bullet, so it's big, like a large bullet. I think the idea was that it would penetrate. Sufficient to penetrate the first thing, but not enough at the first wall, not enough to go out the second, and then we'll grow ricochet around the inside and hopefully get somebody. And so giving lectures to these people on what we knew about enemy equipment. That was done in Cairo, and that went on for, I don't know, 6 months or more. But of course, the Middle East was becoming less involved.
What did you think of the 88? I mean, did you get? I mean, that was you'd used the 3.7. Yeah. The 88 was the era.
Yes, we always thought the 88 was very much better than the 3.7.
Did you have a look at it? I mean, did you?
Yes, well, they were kind of captured. When we'd overrun an Italian or German gun site, we sometimes occupied the same gun site. And there was a gun, German gun being damaged or destroyed, or the Germans had been able to take it away and they destroyed it, you'd have it there. And the photograph of that. And the attacks at the Duxford, near Duxford, near Cambridge, I was there only a week or ago, and they had model that had the same things. And the 88 was much easier to get into action and take out of action. It was designed for more purposes because it could also fire at low elevation, in fact, at depression, it was designed to fire. So if you're on a hill and the tank's coming up, you fire down. We weren't designed for that. We had strikes. So we ourselves never did it in anger, did it in trial, testing, but it wasn't very effective. It wasn't designed for that. It took us longer to get in and out of action than the 88. I think as far as the shell was concerned, it was probably as efficient as each other. But there's always a tendency for all that to say, oh, the enemy equipment's so much better than ours.
What about other things? I mean, the comparison of rifles, submachine guns?
The Germans were in advance of us. We had the Sten gun, I think the Sten. That was the Bren gun, Bren, of course. The machine gun, which was similar, which was a bit of art. Bren, the BR was in Brno in Czechoslovakia, and the N was Enfield, the Enfield rifle, Bren gun. That was quite a good thing, but the Germans, I think, were ahead of us in their planning more advanced equipment. But again, that's amazing. From an overall point of view, I think one of the mistakes the Germans made was that they were preparing for a very short war. And then they turned out the war was going to go a long time. They just didn't understand they couldn't do it. But these, after all, the Luger and the Valter are well known even today as very good quality pistols. We used to have, the American Colt revolvers that we carried.
And they weren't as good.
difficult to say. There were horses for courses. It depends what you were doing. If you were shooting at somebody close, then one gun would be better. Shooting somebody further away, it would be you're more likely to hit them. But if you find the horse died, then that would stop the person in his tracks. But the kickback, the recoil when you hit it would be enormous. But with a 2-2 pistol, it wouldn't be much. But again, the 2-2 person was hit in the arm, he probably must be able to carry on and fight him. But not if he had a 45 hitting him. It would be very difficult to say overall which is better. We used to consider that Rommel was better, the best general ever existed. Of course, the German Lili Marleen was a popular song that we all sang.
What about, the Sten and the Thompson as compared to the Schmeisser, you know, that sort of thing?
I wouldn't say I'm qualified to say the drone gun, because it's different. Although in American films, you see them picking up and firing on the hip, it wasn't designed for that. You'd be lying down on the ground and shooting lying prone. The Schmeisser, who just ever you standing up. In fact, you probably have seven.
But I was meaning compared to Sten and the Tommy gun, Thompson.
To a large extent, I think we were following the Germans. That was the general feeling. That after the Germans had introduced something that I think was very good, then our people get on to producing something similar.
Did you get any new weapons while you were on this duty then? New German weapons that came in that you'd never seen before?
Yes, indeed. There were quite a few. That one, I think it's called the... there was a Panzergranate, I think it's called. Panzer tank. And Granata, the grenade. It was a...
Is that the bazooka or Panzerfaust?
Similar. It was a gun. It wasn't a rocket.
Sorry.
A rocket. It was an old gun. But one of the important things, and the British also did this very well, it was, we call them hollow charge shells, where the front of the shell was in the form of a cone, concavely cone, and it was a tank. And the idea was that when it hit the tank, a force from the whole cone would be directed, focused on a particular point, and there's more chance that it would go through that little point in the armour, then the gases would flow in and cause the damage. That was quite good, and that was also a British development. But they all copied each other, and especially who got in first and made the most of it while he could. But we had a high regard for the German ability, also incidentally, because we were to some slight extent involved with the Russian equipment. And the characteristic that we thought of Russian equipment was that the working parts were beautifully machined and very well done, but all the parts that were not working were just really for show, they left rust without any problem. Whereas our guns, even the parts that never did anything, were still machined, rather pretty and painted over, so it would look nice and smooth. The Russian guns, this was the thing, is in half through, I don't know, but this is what we always thought. Any non-working parts were left just the way they came off the casting when they were cast and left at that, and would look all very rugged, but beautifully machined where it was needed, which I suppose was a good idea. And I think that was the characteristic we thought about the Russian guns. They were also Italian things, but they weren't that important. Somewhat occasional, because the Germans at that time occupied the whole of the Balkans, and there was a thing called Force 133, which at the time was very, very hush-hush, no one seemed to know about it. There were many fools who were working for Force 133, and I imagine probably the information would get around. They would organise raids into Crete and Greece, and also send in supplies and troops to the various resistance fighters out there. Also, another duty we had was unit officers have to take in turns to be on duty in the main general headquarters and receive any messages that came in. And we had to decide whether the message was sufficiently important to go and wake up would be the tutor, I suppose, the second in command of the whole area. He would either in bed or at the Mac Club or somewhere. And very difficult, a message came through saying, because if it was something that was very little important, we'd get a rocket for disturbing him. And so we'd look at, I don't know, it's important, how come we? But we didn't know the overall background strategy of what was going on. And we didn't, of course, then know about any of that, which was a remarkable thing.
So that was just a general staff officer role, that's general as a junior staff officer.
Junior staff officer, okay. The captain then, that was the sort of the army activity. But apart from that, the social activity was out of this world, absolutely out of this world. And you asked me previously about living conditions and so on. Well, as far as officers were concerned, it was absolutely it was wonderful.
Where were you living?
Well, a couple of places. There were hotels in Cairo. Our office, so to speak, was in Councillor Neil Barrett's, which were destroyed, burned down during the revolution, and the British were thrown out. But we were living in hotels, which where we could stay, but discovered that there's a place called Mahdi, MAADI, which was in the news recently on the internet. I wrote quite a bit about it. Mahdi was a suburb, like Hampstead Garden suburb, or Welling Garden City. Maybe Welling Garden City would be a better description. It was also that about distance from Cairo. After Garden City, beautifully, plenty of water, swimming pool, wonderful club, offices, of course, and houses which were.
So you were in hotels in Mahdi?
No. In Cairo would be in hotels, but in Mahdi would be in apartments. Apartments which were owned previously by wealthy Egyptians or Syrians who would use it as a holiday place. Syrians seem to come down from everywhere. As a holiday holiday home, or people from Cairo who also used it as a second summer residence. And there were very nicely fixed up, and there'd be about four of us occupying one, and I discovered that there was a vacancy when I spoke to them. I said, oh yes, I'm joining in, and went there, and it was magnificent. The system was that early in the morning, probably about 7:30 before it got hot, there'd be a truck taking us all into Cairo to our offices, everybody over to GHQ. And then we'd work, and then about 12 o'clock, we'd driven back to Mahdi, lunch, swim, whatever in the afternoon. And at 5 o'clock, or certainly 5 o'clock and 7 o'clock, we're back at the offices. And either at 7 o'clock, we went back with the truck, or you were staying in Cairo to spend the evening there, and then find your own way back to Mahdi. The accommodation was very comfortable, and we had what was called a Safragi. He was an Arab, Egyptian, who spoke in French and Arabic, very little English, but we got by. He was the sort of major domo. He was the pastor of the whole place, around the place, did the cooking, and he was an excellent cook. And then he introduced me to mangoes. I don't think I'd ever had mangoes previously. Mangoes now are everywhere, but then I was taught how to eat them, but special technique. All that was absolutely bliss. And we had parties there. We'd come into Cairo, and they involved with some her families. There was an English family called Wallace, Captain Wallace, who lived out there. There were other people, Syrian, who were French. French was the other language, but the normal language that was spoken by everybody. Many of them were sort of British, Syrian, and British Egyptians, they had two passports. And generally they were fairly well off. And I remember also an interesting thing. In England, they had white bread throughout the war. And that was very important, even though the nutritionists and people didn't know. But for morale purposes, we had white bread. Out there, in the army, we had black bread. We also had white bread. Sorry, we also had white bread out in the army. It was sort of white bread. But the civilians had to make do generally with black bread, or brown, dark brown bread, grey rough bread. But on the black market, he would get white. And when we were invited to dinner, or whatever it is, as a special procession, they'd give us white bread. but we wanted them. The local blackbird was wonderful, by contrast, anyway, with other birds. Enjoyed it all the time. And there was a world of customers, so, oh, thank you very much. Well, they would much rather have had the answer. Social life was fantastic. And some of the parties went to, look back, some of the social life in Cairo, especially throughout the war, but particularly, I mean, the war in North Africa continent was absolutely fantastic. And there was a lot of wealth, wonderful wines, attractive women, and as you know, lots of women invited to often. I remember one, there was Lord Killian, he was the British ambassador, but he was the British ambassador in these days, Wallace ran the country. And he was he who told Farouk that he had to behave himself, do what he was told, or he'd be half on his neck.
What was one of these parties like, if you can remember?
Yes, absolutely glamorous. There'd be loads of food, beautiful surroundings. Some of the houses they lived in, there was a place called Zamalek in the old banks of the Nile, near the Gezira Club, sporting club, which was only for officers or for members. Wonderful houses, big entrances, beautiful mosaics, and different houses. And one particular family, Lacoste, that was very much involved with, was a girl named Alice Lacoste, who taught me how to make paper swans, you know, origami. And I've carried it on ever since. Thousands of people have learned it from me. I learned that from her. The procedure, which I hadn't been used to before, but you learn quickly. When you call at the house, you're expected. The safari, all rent dressed in all white and all that would meet you, take you into a lounge, sort of low armchair, magnificent decorations, and someone will come in with cold drinks for you. You sit there waiting. Your hostess, person who gets it, didn't come in yet. So you were there for a certain number of minutes, I don't know, probably convention how long you stayed, then she would come in. I think you sit and talk and have tea or whatever it is in a very formal way. Then maybe make the meeting, you go out and it would be less formal. The that was the hotel, the Shepherd's Hotel, of course. You know, one known Shepherd's Hotel. I used to stay there very frequently. That was one of the main about Raffles in Singapore, King David in Jerusalem. There were a few hotels like that around the Empire, which were built up and were absolutely magnificent. Shepherds were burned down, and the modern state shepherds were not the same thing at all. So the accommodation down in Mali was absolutely magnificent. I don't know how long that lasted, but things were starting to wind up. The GSI in Cairo was beginning to get smaller, but there was a school, so it's called Middle East School of Military Intelligence, in Gaza. That's the thing doing recently, but that's been going for some time, although I only came across it around about this time. And I was seconded, sent to run a course at this school in Gaza.
Now, what was the course you were running in?
Running on the same sort of equipment, enemy equipment. We used to train on the use of enemy guns, rifles, machine guns, and also anti-tank guns. And it was once a terrible, we had a German anti-tank gun firing from them, which was firing heavy shells. That's been the equivalent of certainly a 3.7 or even more, 25 pound or something like that. And a new chap had come along as a sergeant, and we'd normally do the drills to show the intelligence units with dummy ammunition. And we'd load and try to go through a whole drill. We didn't have any dummy ammunition for some reason there. So we said, well, use an ordinary shell, but make sure they don't fire. Here you have a whole drill leading up to the position where you fire.